Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the Trump White House is more overtly Christian than ever before.
And a look at this fall's most anticipated movies.
But first this morning, the chaos surrounding food stamp benefits continues in Arizona, even as the longest government shutdown in U.S. history could be nearing an end. Some Arizonans who rely on SNAP food aid to buy groceries received their funds on Friday, but then many were blocked after the Supreme Court stepped in and granted the Trump administration's emergency appeal to block the court order that had made them fully fund the program. Now the federal government is telling states that did pay the benefits to undo it, and President Trump has said SNAP benefits would not be paid until the government shutdown ends. All of this back and forth has left nearly 900,000 Arizonans who rely on food stamps in limbo for weeks. These are low-income Americans. Many are disabled. Most are in families with children. More than 40% of them are in working families. That is all according to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. So we wanted to hear how this is impacting their lives. So I went down to St. Mary's Food Bank in West Phoenix last week to talk to some of them. And spokesperson Jerry Brown gave me the lay of the land.
So this is a tightly run operation here.
Yeah, it's like a NASCAR pit stop. 8 cars roll in every 2.5 minutes. We started this during COVID when it was non-contact, but we've been doing it for 4 years now because the number of people has just increased since COVID. We're seeing more people now than we did during the height of the COVID pandemic, and that was pre-SNAP, pre-government shutdown. Now we're seeing another 10 to 15% on top of that.
The line of cars waiting to get a box of food wrapped around the block. By the time they make it to the front of the line, they've been separated into 3 lines of cars waiting to pull up one group at a time and have volunteers fill up their trunks with food.
Okay, so 1,200 people today.
Yeah, at least. You know, I think it was 1,405 on Tuesday that we saw at this location. But across our network, we're more like 50,000 a week.
So I took my 2.5 minutes each to get a sense of who is coming to the food bank amid this shutdown and why.
Excuse me, sir. Hi, I'm Lauren. I'm with KJZZ News. Mind if I ask you a couple questions?
Go ahead.
What's your name, first of all?
Richard Brown.
Could you tell me your name?
Amanda. Jess.
I can tell you, Zero. My friends call me Zero.
Tell me a little bit about what you're doing here today.
Trying to pick up some food. Bills is exorbitant. And I need some food in the house.
How many people in your house?
3.
Have you been coming here for a long time, or is this something new for you?
3rd trip.
Just ever?
Yeah, ever.
What changed?
The economy changed. No food stamps. And just trying to make it, trying to eat.
Tell us, you know, what brought you here today?
The no stamps, you know, the no SNAP. Yeah, definitely.
No food stamps this week?
Food stamps this week. And we're just waiting for them to open it up. Might as well come and get some assistance. We're, you know, it's not abused or anything, but just whenever you need it. And we're thankful for it. You know, we're thankful.
So you were on food stamps and didn't get those benefits this week?
Correct.
Do you mind me asking how much you usually got?
It's like $450.
And this time, nothing?
Nothing.
It's like close to $300.
Yeah. Yeah. And now that didn't come this week?
No. No, it didn't.
What does that mean for you?
Trying not to do something bad. Trying to just keep my head above water.
You know, as an American, you pay your dues. Like, taxes comes first before you see your paycheck. And, you know, I felt like they knocked us on our feet, you know, off our feet. Like, for a split second, I really feel for people that have, you know, small children. The economy's bad, the tariffs, like, everything. If something was $3, it's now close to $6.
So the food they just loaded up in the back of your car here, a box of food, some emergency groceries, like, what does that mean for you, your family?
It's a lot to me, because these day labor jobs not paying anymore. You know where you're going to find something that's going to hire you right off the street now.
Excuse me, ma'am. Hi. I'm with KJZZ News. Would you be willing to talk to me for a minute while you unload up here?
Yeah.
Tell me your name.
It's Janita Rhodes.
Is this the first time you've come here?
Yes, it is.
What brought you here today?
My food stamps day was on the 4th, and I didn't get no food stamps, nor did I get the $50 gift card that everybody else was getting. So I've actually been looking around to go to them daily. Because going from $750 to no dollars in food stamps, four kids, three of them boys, and one girl that eat like the boy, that shit is hard.
Can you tell me your name?
Amelia.
Yeah. Tell me what brought you here today.
With this shutdown, government shutdown, no food stamps. I don't work. I just get a disability for him, for my son. So I'm struggling right now. By the time I pay the rent and everything, it's, you know, it's hard to get the other necessities that we need.
What's a meal look like with this kind of food or with food stamps, and then what's a meal look like without it?
Stressful. A meal with food stamps is a whole different world to having to have a meal with no food stamps now and have to figure it out.
Tell me what this box of food you're getting today will mean for your family. What can you do with it?
More than a week probably of having groceries, something to on the table.
Without it, would you have nothing?
Not really. Because like I said, you know, by the time I pay rent and everything, so it's kind of struggling right now.
So do you know why SNAP was cut off, why you didn't get that money this week?
Basically, Trump said he's not going to pay it. But he sent $40 million overseas, but he ain't going to feed us.
Are you mad?
I'm very mad. Very mad.
It's like not even the fact that you might go hungry. It's just scary at the fact that a matter of what could happen to not be hungry. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Everybody's not going to have the mind frame that we got to come to a food bank. Some people going to steal.
Or they can't.
And you said you know this because of the government shutdown. How do you feel about that?
Not too happy with that. A lot of us that really need the help, you know. He's cutting out all the help that everybody needs.
Who do you blame?
Trump.
Why? Tell me.
I guess he knows that everybody needs the help and he's just withholding all the funds, you know.
Yeah, we're supposed to be making America great again, but the way they're doing it and going about it is not right. It's not ethical.
Thank you. We got to keep it going. Thank you. The ongoing federal government shutdown has impacted many social safety net programs, from SNAP to the Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC program, to Head Start, to TANF, for temporary assistance for needy families. And for a lot of Arizonans, those programs are interrelated. Recipients of one are, in many cases, recipients of others. So what does the funding disruption and uncertainty mean for those residents who rely on these programs? And is there a better way to administer them and help lift people out of poverty? Our co-host Mark Brody talked more about this with Tom Riley, a professor in the School of Public Affairs at ASU. And they started with what all of the uncertainty surrounding these social safety net programs does to the people who rely on them.
Well, that uncertainty creates an incredible amount of distress, obviously, because all these programs, you know, they kind of intersect together where many individuals are receiving multiple programs. Mm-hmm. So those that perhaps are on Medicaid are on SNAP. If they have small children or infants or on WIC, they're getting assistance with their heating and energy. So when we look at, you know, this cutting all these type of programs kind of coming together, those that are perhaps even not on Medicaid but are receiving ACA premiums, those are targeted to increase. You have a large impact on, you know, a significant number of at-risk individuals. I mean, let's just take SNAP, is that, you know, 1 in 9 Arizonans receive SNAP benefits.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about a small portion. And those SNAP individuals that receive SNAP benefits are on other multiple programs too.
Well, so what does that do for the state and maybe for the, in addition to the sort of individuals or their family's economy, for the state's economy to have all that, as you describe it, distress?
Well, you know, what has been a staple since we've developed our safety net programs is the federal government has funded it. And we've moved more towards state administration. But that's kind of been a staple, right, is that to make an abrupt shift to pass the financial burden to the state or to local nonprofits can occur overnight, even if it could ever occur. But you can't have an abrupt stoppage of programs that have for a long period of time been funded by the federal government, and that has been a significant responsibility of them. And then all of a sudden, stop, because you do not have the capability. States can't respond. The nonprofit sector can't respond. And I think that's what we're seeing here.
Do you get the sense that this shutdown and maybe what we've seen during it, could that lead to other changes in the way what we call social safety net programs are administered or funded or run, or maybe even whether or not they exist going forward?
Well, you know, we've always kind of struggled with how we treat safety net programs in the United States, right? So we've gone back and forth from expansion to retrenchment. You know, since 2010, you know, clearly we have moved away from kind of these traditional cash welfare towards more in-kind, work-supported, or programs that are actually not run through our traditional welfare programs but run through the IRS.
Yeah, like tax credit kind of things.
Yeah, to address their tax burden or to boost wages of low-income workers. So we've always kind of seen this fundamental shift, and you know, we very well might be looking to continue on that pathway, is to develop a lot of our safety net programs through programs like the IRS, where they're tied into income, they're tied into work requirements, but they have less stigma perhaps than associated with the traditional Department of Human Services or economic security or welfare program.
Would that be a more effective way to help folks? Because after all, that is the goal of all these programs, right, is to help folks who don't have enough money to buy the things they need to be able to buy the things they need and, in theory, make it sustainable so that they don't need the assistance going forward.
Well, the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit, and under COVID, the expanded child tax credit, had the most significant impact on child poverty in the United States. Hmm. The research on these programs clearly is impressive as far as if we're looking at the overall goal of reducing child poverty. Both these programs are run through the IRS. The Earned Income Tax Program is available to families with children and non-children, although it's more generous with the issue of children. It's geared towards boosting wages of low-income earners, and it phases out once you get to a certain phase. The child tax credit obviously is only for families with children, mm-hmm. but it's basically to lessen the tax burden of families. So both these programs, the way they operate right now, at least at the federal level, is that you get the refund or the credit when you submit your taxes. So these programs are – and they're also – have bipartisan support. That's
right.
Kind of, you know, is that for different reasons, Republicans and Democrats like it. But one is that they're basically tied into some type of earned income, right? They phase out and they're run through the IRS. They're not run through these traditional programs. So there's less stigma on it. You know, but like everything else, it's how much you support and expand these programs.
Given the success that you cited of these two programs, would it make sense to maybe look to either further expand them or maybe create new programs like that that could, in theory, even like replace SNAP or LIHEAP or some of these other safety net programs?
I think so. You know, so basically how these programs operate through the IRS, through receiving, you know, actually refundable tax credits, the family decides how best to use those, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I said earlier we've kind of moved away from cash assistance program. So what we've kind of seen is this increase of 30 years ago, we never talked about work requirements. That is a given. Both Democrats and Republicans accept that, you know, that whether it's Medicaid or whether it's any type, if you're able-bodied, you should work. So these type of programs operate real well there. However, you know, let's take the SNAP population. 1 in 9 individuals are on it. 1 in 4 are children.
In Arizona.
Yeah, in Arizona. 1 in 3 are elderly. And there's a sizable number of disabled.
Right.
Right. So we're still dealing with a population, right, that either can't work, right, or not eligible to work. And you can't tie in that work requirement of it too. So where are these work requirement programs that are based upon taxes and income and run through their lives are very, very, very successful, even for children with their parents. there still is a need for a population, perhaps, that can't work or still need benefits that need to be administered. What I will say is that what we've seen as a staple is that the federal government has continued, right, to fund these programs, right? Now, they've changed for more state-administered, but there has been kind of the staple of that has been the role of the federal government. And that's why, going back to your initial point, is that the federal government can't just stop doing all this, right, without some type of transition, right? Because there is not the capacity from a revenue standpoint or just a capacity of delivering the services at the nonprofit or faith-based group.
All right. That is Tom Riley, a professor in the School of Public Affairs at ASU. Tom, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a trilogy of plays inspired by years of conversations with tribal members from around the country.
But first...
You know something? Maybe once a week, I wake up paralyzed, reliving that night. But before the sun went down, I think that was the best day of my life.
I can make your parents hurt themselves. I can make them hurt each other. I can make them eat each other if I want to.
Guess this is the end of the line, huh?
Not for you. Ocean waves. Ocean waves.
Well, you just heard clips from Weapons, Sinners, and One Battle After Another, three of the year's most acclaimed films. With Oscar season approaching, each of them has attracted plenty of awards buzz. But of course, there are plenty more eagerly anticipated releases to come this fall. And joining me now with a preview is filmmaker, film critic, and Indigenous programmer for the Phoenix Film Festival, Monty Yazzie. Monty, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Let's start just quickly with the last film in that montage, Paul Thomas Anderson's One Battle After Another. That film came out at the end of September. Seemed to me like it was kind of the starting pistol for prestige movie season. Is that fair to say?
Very much so. Paul Thomas Anderson, one of my favorite filmmakers. I always make it a point to watch anything that he puts out. And his new film, One Battle After Another, was definitely a film that was very, very much well-regarded and really a filmmaker making movies for film fans.
Just sticking with the other two films in that montage for a moment, Weapons and Sinners, just because I know you're a big horror fan, what do you make of the acclaim and box office success that those movies have enjoyed?
Yeah, Sinners came out early in the year, and the fact that people are still talking about it is really a staple to its success. Sinners has like almost transcended this idea that it's a horror film, and I think people are talking about it in a very, very accomplished way because it is filmmaking that is kind of taking a look at history and putting in that input of trauma and into this really like interesting story about vampires. And, and Weapons is kind of the same thing where it's like, you know, domestic terror and this like really scary situation that involves kids. It hits on all those nerve endings that people are you know, those buttons that really bring up those ideas of what is like true horror. And Weapons does it in a very, very ingenious, mysterious way.
We have also, Monty, already seen the release just this month of some other very buzzed about films. The Smashing Machine comes to mind, After the Hunt and Begonia. Anything you've seen from those films that stands out to you or surprised you?
You know, the most entertaining man in professional wrestling history, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, it's surprising to say he almost disappears into the role of this UFC fighter. And I was very shocked that he was able to accomplish that. You know, the prosthetic makeup and the tone of the film.
This is in the film, The Smashing Machine.
In The Smashing Machine, yeah. It really does allow him to disappear into the role. I thought he was really great in it. And Begonia, you know, a movie that is a remake of a 2003 South Korean film that came out many, many years ago and not a lot of people watched. Begonia updates it with these great actors and brings in this like paranoid conspiracy theory topic that really plays to kind of the tone of our world today, influenced by social media and all these different, you know, who's telling the truth and who isn't telling the truth kind of ideas. And it does so in a really funny, like almost darkly comic way. And Emma Stone, you know, local actress here in Arizona, does an amazing job again. Just continues to be a phenomenal actress.
As you look ahead to the rest of November and December, what are the other really big releases that you have got your eye on?
Oh, there's some big ones coming out. I just watched one recently called The Running Man, which for those fans of the 1980s Arnold Schwarzenegger film, The Running Man, this film is a more true adaptation to Stephen King's novel. And Edgar Wright, you know, the guy who made Scott Pilgrim vs. the World and Baby Driver, does such a great job with, like, kind of keeping this, like, thrilling button on the pulse of, like, action films. And also this idea that he's introducing a lot of, like, what society is kind of touching on. It's kind of an angry film at times, very political film at times. But also, like, this idea that entertainment value is really the core concept of what this movie is. And it's violent and it's scary and it's funny and it's really well done. Also, like, looking forward, you know, to the rest of the year, you know, there's so many films that are coming out now. And it's hard to keep it, you know, especially for those of my friends that are critic group people. You know, we have to keep updated with these movies consistently over the next few weeks. But, you know, it'd be remiss to not say that Wicked, the Wicked sequel,
of course,
is going to be a big one that people are going to be looking out for, especially for musicals. And also looking forward to, like, just a plethora of other films that are coming out that I think Jay Kelly with the George Clooney and Adam Sandler's film going to Netflix is going to be a much talked about film. I look at movies that are coming out as well, too, like some biopics. Nuremberg is going to be a very talked about, you know, documentary film, as well as like a host of other films as well, too. You know, it's almost hard to keep up with how many are coming out at this time.
Well, kind of in that vein, I realize this is maybe going to be about an impossible question to answer. We have just about a minute left, Monty. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could identify any particular theme or emergent idea that stands out to you amongst the best movies you've watched this year.
Yeah, you know, I go back and talk about how society and cinema can be a reflection of the society that we're living in. And right now there's a lot of angry cinema. There's a lot of cinema that is kind of touching on this idea that people are fed up, you know, they are tired of being misrepresented, that the idea that our political fatigue is starting to build up to this point where people are just getting upset. And it's reflected in the films that we see now and, you know, things like One Battle After Another, The Running Man, you know, even the documentaries that we're getting, these commentaries, you know, about, you know, people just wanting to do more with the world and wanting to see it change for the future. And, you know, there's something really amazing about that. And also, like, you know, looking at cinema, it's definitely someplace I think that's going to be a very good topic to go to.
Well, that is filmmaker and film critic Monty Yazzie. Monty, thank you as always.
Thank you.
The American experiment has always been tethered to religion, whether it's In God We Trust or the principle of religious freedom. But under the Trump White House, religion, Christianity in particular, has perhaps never been so front and center. President Trump has received massive support from the evangelical Christian community since his first run for president. And there is now a White House Faith Office and a Religious Liberty Commission. Trump has expanded the influence of conservative Christians in the White House, and he's declared he's bringing back religion in our country. The funeral of Turning Point USA founder Charlie Kirk here at State Farm Stadium in Glendale was chock full of Trump administration officials. Trump himself called it an old time revival more than a funeral. It's what our next guest calls the rise of Christian nationalism, and it raises questions about the role of religion in our government today. John Carlson is the director of the Center for Religion and Conflict at ASU. I asked him if we've ever been here before, and he told me not for a long time.
This is not the kind of phenomenon that we've seen since World War II in the 20th century, the kind of very easy coalescence between many on the Christian right and in this administration, including people in this administration who aren't necessarily even Christian. Mm-hmm. It does kind of blend and fuse together in a way that I think most people are not at all used to. And that's not really in keeping with what has been the tradition of past administrations, both Republican and Democrat in the past.
So what's that looked like traditionally? Like, you, I think every president we've had has been religious, right? Christian of some kind, but not as explicit, not as willing to kind of cross that line, that unspoken line between church and state.
Yes, I think that's very fair to say. And I mean, the United States is pretty unique in that it's always had a very strong religious history that has continued up to this day. And even as religious membership or identity has declined in certain places, there's still a very strong heritage that's brought in and sometimes incorporated into what's called the civil religion. So mm-hmm. presidents who, you know, use the God Bless America, that George H.W. Bush famously prayed in his very first words in his that first act right. as president. Many presidents have done that, actually, Eisenhower too. And there's always been media coverage of presidents attending church or sitting in a certain pew or things of that nature. So none of that is new. In fact, you don't actually see that very much with Donald Trump. It's a very different understanding and use, if you will, of religion. So yes, I think this is very much unprecedented and very new and very – for a lot of people, it's very concerning and disarming.
Yeah, yeah. So how are we seeing this, in your opinion, kind of manifest itself? Like watching the Charlie Kirk funeral on television, which was so overtly Christian and evangelical, I think was an eye-opener to a lot of America. But are there policies? Is it affecting the government and the way the government's actually functioning, you think?
This is a great question. There's a lot of different pieces of this. So I think that what you saw surrounding the Charlie Kirk assassination and then his memorial service was very much in keeping with what a lot of people recognize or call Christian nationalist instincts, which is a kind of very robust fusing between religious ideas generally of the Christian right and political ideas also of the political right. And that is something that past government officials or presidents may have held those views privately or even talked about them publicly. George Bush famously said Jesus was his favorite political philosopher, right? We remember that. That's however, different than this kind of fusing of this narrative in a particularly in a memorial service where, you know, Charlie Kirk is cast equally as a Christian martyr as he is a martyr of America, mm-hmm. And those who might have some objection to how Charlie Kirk is being remembered or how he's being honored are deemed sort of un-American, and in some cases they're having even their rights stripped away. So that's a very different kind of look to how you manage religious and political views, and so it starts to take form in policies, mm-hmm. And so. That's a concern for a lot of us.
Is this Christian nationalism? Is that what we're watching happen?
I think that's a form or a manifestation of Christian nationalism, yes. The idea that you can display this, embrace this in and as part of your official duties mm-hmm. as a government official, whether that's, you know, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, you know, saying the Lord's Prayer, you know, in a public gathering or wearing his religion on his sleeve, so mm-hmm. to speak, in his official capacity, or whether it's, you know, all of the staffers, all of the – I was on a plane coming – flying from D.C. to Phoenix the day before Charlie Kirk's funeral, and that was filled with staffers and federal officials and, you know, very high-ranking ones who are all coming out for the service. That kind of thing is an overt manifestation and shows that it's not just a sort of, you know, someone who might think a certain way or have some certain ideas about, you know, being a good Christian means being a good American and vice mm-hmm. versa, that they're more or less the same. And an administration who's, you know, avidly embracing that as part of its policy approach.
Okay, so then we have to talk about the implications of that, right? Because this is a country that I think for a lot of folks, we've assumed there is a separation of church and state, and also a celebration of diversity of religion, of freedom of religion, right? Like, you can be Muslim in this country and practice that faith freely. You can be Christian in this country and practice that faith freely. Will we lose that? Are we in danger of that, you think?
Well, it's possible. I mean, there's a number of different reasons for opposing Christian nationalism, one of which would be from a kind of strict constitutionalist point of view, which is to say anything that smacks of an established religion within the government is inherently unconstitutional. That's not what the framers set out for. Now, you'd have to actually test that in the courts because the separation of church and state, as it's sometimes called, is really a legal battle that's fought and waged case by case. There's a very different set of questions, however, when you get to start to thinking about, well, should religion be, you know, fused so and intermingled so freely, certainly a particular kind of religion like Christian nationalism with political life? And for those who are not Christian, they might say, no, absolutely not. This is exclusionary, or I don't – what about me? I serve in the military as well. You're speaking as if you're representing all of us, but you don't. Mm. And then there's the other point of view, which is for a lot of Christians, Christian nationalism is not very Christian. It is not what they understand to be Christianity. They may say it's idolatrous. This puts the nation over God. You can't reconcile some of the claims and teachings of Jesus with what Christian nationalists argue.
That's really interesting. Pushback on both ends there. So let me ask you lastly, John, about, I guess, where we go from here in your opinion. Like, how do we find a place we can all live and work together and kind of have some kind of semblance of fundamental equality when it comes to religion, if in fact we are in this moment in which, you know, the government is more and more explicitly religious and one kind?
Well, one of the things that I would say that is a great attribute of the United States is that we have this kind of long-standing, I'll call it a democratic faith. Maybe others call it a civil religion. You can think of it in different ways. But whether it's, you know, in God we trust on our coins or the inaugural prayers or words of a president as he or she's assuming the office, there's a long, long history. So there's a way in which this kind of deep democratic faith, I mean, and faith in its full rich sense of the term is deeply American and goes back to the beginning and has always been part of us. And interestingly, as Christian nationalism suffuses the current administration, civil religion has receded in that. Hmm. And why that's important is civil religion is a lot more inclusive and encompassing. It makes room for new voices to emerge, but to join a religion that can unite or a civic creed that can unite, that's not nationalistic, that's actually instead of closing down the borders or closing down the categories of who belongs, you know, sort of says this, it's not about those other features of who you are, what, including what party you are, it's about what you believe. And that's, I think, really where religion and politics have a potential and a role to play in our current environment.
All right, we'll leave it there. That is John Carlson, director of the Center for Religion and Conflict at ASU, as well as associate professor of religious studies there. John, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Back in 2022, the state of Arizona got access to a big infusion of federal money. Over $30 million flowed into the state to fund 164 summer learning camps designed to make up for lost classroom time that students missed out on during the COVID-19 pandemic. Most of those camps were a success, but in some cases, the money was either misspent or never spent at all. According to an analysis in the Arizona Republic, over $5 million went to, quote, disallowed expenses, and over $6 million went unspent. Governor Hobbs's office is now attempting to claw back as much of that money as possible. They have recouped close to $900,000 so far. Mary Jo Pitzel wrote that piece in The Republic looking into all this. She focused in particular on money that went to one of the most egregious offenders, the Earth and Space Expedition Center. As she told me recently, much of the problem stemmed from the loose rules governing the AZ OnTrack program funds.
The state got millions of dollars from the feds to fund these summer camps, and there were pretty loose regulations or restrictions on how the money was to be used. There apparently were not strong provisions for how to see if the money was being spent properly before it went out the door.
Right. And this was sort of a unique feature of the AZ On Track program, right? There was this idea that the money would be dispersed and there would at some point be an audit of how the money was spent.
Correct. And the need for, I mean, when it was rolled out in 2022, it was touted as having, you know, less red tape, fewer, strings attached, because there was a sense that you had to get this money out pretty quickly, get these camps stood up. You can't leave the kids, way behind on the learning curve for too long, and you've got to get rolling. And the thought was that they would catch errors on the backside.
So coming back to the Earth and Space Expedition Center, the way that they used their grant money from AZ On Track is very indicative of the pitfalls of that approach.
Well, they were going to use it to provide learning programs, look at the name of the organization, Earth and Science. So it would do a lot of really STEM, science, technology, with a lot of really cool equipment, right? Because you're dealing with, with space travel and science discovery. So there was talk of getting a flight simulator built using some of the AZ On Track dollars. That ultimately did not happen. And we can talk a little bit about that later.
So the Earth and Space Expedition Center was one of the larger grantees of this program at $1.25 million. The state now wants $1.1 million of that amount back, which is obviously the vast majority of that funding. A big part of the problem here is that the former executive director of the Earth and Space Expedition Center, Beverly Swayman, who was there when these grants came in, has since left. Tell us a little bit about why the state is concerned about what the center used the money for under Swayman's direction and what she told you about that.
So as the state started to go through basically a form of audit of the spending, they found just case after case where the documents that were sent in to say we spent money on A, B, and C did not meet the federal requirements. The center got the money and just started spending it. They did start down the path of trying to buy a flight simulator. And when the governor's office got a look at that, they said, no, you can't do that. This is money that's supposed to pay for the learning exercise, not for tangible equipment that, has a long shelf life. I mean, this is supposed to support things that would happen during a summer session, not a flight simulator that would live on and could be used, by the center, for future endeavors where they're charging the public to come in and use it. There were just a lot of problems with the records, complicated by the fact that Ms. Swayman left the center. And according to one of the board members who sort of had to pick up the mess here and figure out what was going on, the records were in disarray. And the board is in the process of trying to dissolve so that they do not incur the responsibility for this. And I will say that the board's chairman, a guy named Jerry Darren, seems to be making a really good faith effort to work with the governor's office to try to track down this money. But they really can't. The money's not there to be recouped.
Yeah.
He believes, but can't prove, that probably a lot of it just went to keep the center running because it seemed to have hit hard times.
Right.
But again, that was not the point of the grant.
The details of what he's had to go through to unwind all of this are pretty remarkable, right? I mean, he's basically had to dig through boxes that are divided across a series of storage units.
Yes. It was literally a look at a storage container that was just a jumble of equipment, paper, receipts, just sort of stuffed in boxes, no kind of apparent orderly system. So imagine walking into that storage unit and trying to figure out what the heck, that was going on with the Science Center.
And you alluded to this a moment ago, Mary Jo, but I think it bears repeating. One of the other very bizarre elements of this story is that partially because of the way Swayman seems to have been running things, there has been some danger for the interim president of the board that you mentioned. There is some possibility that he, as an individual, along with the other members of the board, could be held personally liable for this money.
Right. And that's why the board decided that they need to go out of business. They, they're registered as a nonprofit, but there's a procedure you have to go through to close out such an operation. The last I checked, that was still on track, and the governor's office was sympathetic to the situation that they were in. So this could leave the state just holding the bag, meaning there will be no refund and basically no accountability.
Well, that, of course, brings us to what you get to at the end of your piece, which is that Governor Hobbs's office has characterized the AZ OnTrack program as, quote, a bad grant process. What did they tell you about the state of their efforts to claw back this missing and misspent money? And how are they working with the State House to resolve this?
Well, the way the process works is once the budget office has completed its review and reached its conclusions that, you know, some of these summer camps didn't spend the money properly, they make requests for send the money back, pay us back. And when nothing happens on that front, then they refer that money due to the Attorney General's office. Fun fact, the state attorney general is basically the collections agent for state government. And as of last week, I checked, and nothing has yet been collected from the Earth and Science Center, nor from some of these other camps. But these grants were in 2022. I mean, we are near the end of 2025. And notably, you know, 1 year left in the current administration. So you do wonder how effective the efforts to collect money will be, and if anybody will pursue that after the next election, when there's the possibility that there could be new players in the governor's office and in the attorney general's office.
Well, Mary Jo Pitzel is a former reporter at the Arizona Republic, and we have been discussing one of her last stories there about the AZ OnTrack program. Mary Jo, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks a lot, Sam. I really appreciate it.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. For over a decade now, theater artists Larissa Fasthorse and Michael John Garces have been traveling around the country, meeting with indigenous communities to conduct what they call talking circles in Los Angeles, South Dakota, and here in Arizona. Fasthorse and Garces invited tribal members to gather and speak frankly about their lives, the cultural issues they were wrestling with, their relationships with their identities, and meaningful stories they wanted to see told on stage. The result is a trilogy of plays, Urban Res, Wichun, and Native Nation. Fasthorse and Garces call the trilogy the Native Nation Project, and now they are releasing a book that collects the text, of all three plays, along with some essays about how they were developed and performed. I spoke with them recently about how these talking circles shaped their work, and I began by asking Fasthorse for an example of the conversational prompts they used in these sessions. She told me that one thing they often ask is for people to talk about their relationships to their names.
It's always a very large, sometimes very fraught question. And so I think, you know, we've gotten so many interesting ways of looking at how people relate to their indigeneity today. Mm-hmm. Through that, like here in California specifically, there are people who are like, I have this name that was a Spanish name, and it was for safety because our people, you know, were being hunted by the state of California, and they were being paid. You know, there was a bounty,
yeah,
on the heads of Native people here by the state, you know, given by the state of California. So indigenous people were taking on Spanish names to hide themselves, and then trying to reclaim their identity after doing it literally to save their life was so incredibly complicated, and ended up with many of those tribes being declared extinct by the federal government in the 1950s. And they're still fighting to this day to get that declaration reversed.
I'd be interested to hear from both of you about the creative ethos that underpins the plays that came out of this work, which, Larissa, you have called that ethos, quote, intentionally incompatible experiences for non-Indigenous audiences.
That does sound like me.
Well, tell me what you mean by that. And Michael, I, I'd be curious to get your take on what that means to you as well.
I mean, I don't think that's the entire central thesis of what we're doing.
Sure.
I think what has risen out of our conversations over many years, Michael and I together saw a way that in what we're hearing from the community about their incredible erasure, that we could create an experience for non-Indigenous people to feel what it's like to be uncomfortable on and feel unwelcome on a space that you thought you were very comfortable on,
yeah,
and that you felt very secure in.
Right.
And that was actually came specifically from the community request to us, which was one of the things we say is, where should this play happen? Who should it be for? And they said, we want it to be to other people. We need allies. We need help. There aren't enough of us. The government isn't listening. We've been battling with them for, you know, decades. We need other people to understand what we're feeling, what we're going through. And so Michael and I saw art as a way to create a visceral experience of belonging and then not belonging.
There was a way of using space, right? Like, we created space in urban res in a way that people had to really be touching the ground. People were moving. You could not, it was not possible to see all the story. Like, stories happen with a lot of simultaneity. There were stories, different stories happening in different parts of a circle, but we weren't in like different rooms. It wasn't like, a thing where you were kind of going on a journey and moving through different rooms. We were all in the same space, but not everybody got all of the story. And I think that forced people to deal with a lot of uncertainty as to what was going on. And then at the end of the play, we all sort of came together in a circle to see sort of the final few scenes. And then there was a moment where we danced together. It was a circle dance. And, you know, there's a lot of resistance to quote-unquote audience participation and, you know, among many theatergoers. But this was really beyond audience participation. This was really like, you are in this space. This event is happening together. And the only way we come out with any kind of feeling of resolution, or even if not resolution, at least the sense of possibility of resolution, is if we do this dance together. And you can choose to participate or not, but that choice really, really dictates a lot of what you and others walk out of here with.
In the vein of a lot of these themes and moments that we've been talking about, I wanted to ask you both about a scene from Native Nation, which is the play in the trilogy that was developed through the Talking Circles here in Arizona. And there's a number of really fascinating scenes in that piece. One of them is, there's this guy named Dennis who, thinking, it seems to me, that he is asking a sensitive question, says to an Indigenous Marine Corps veteran, "I've never understood how so many of you serve." And they start talking, and eventually the veteran says, "I was called to protect my land and my people through the path of a warrior. My tribe doesn't have a way to do that anymore. So I looked around and saw that the Marine Corps gave me the opportunity to follow my calling and protect my nation, my sovereign nation."
Yeah, I mean, most people don't realize that like per capita, Native American people serve in the military at higher numbers than any other racial group in mm-hmm. this continent. Mm-hmm. And that's been true since World War I, when we were not citizens of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And we spoke to a lot of military people, and they were very clear on why they served, and also very clear on having differing feelings about that. You know, like it or not, the occupying nation is occupying our nation. So these are our lands where they're defending. These are our people that they're defending and taking care of, that right. We don't have our own individual militaries to do that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have an endless, confusing and fascinating overlap of governments here in this North American space that we're all reckoning with in so many ways.
You know, so far we've been talking a lot about the dynamic of how these communities are or are not legible to audiences outside of these communities. But there's also a lot of exploration of issues that create tension within the communities themselves, like gender. And there is a sequence in Native Nation where some characters are discussing how a tribal member who has come out as trans fits or maybe does not fit into a traditional ceremony that is very gendered.
When we did Native Nation, there was a real sense of people talking about things. These are things that we're not talking about enough in our community, or these are tensions in our community. We would like those surfaced in this so people can be inspired to talk about them, right? Or to grapple with them overtly. And the specific complex and fraught circumstance of trans people on tribal lands in Arizona was a big topic of conversation. Our first two performances of Native Nation were at the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community. And after the second one, I think it was the lieutenant governor at the time of Salt River stood up and it was, you know, asked to speak, and he spoke, and, you know, he started out by saying he was really angry. He said, "I'm really, you know, I've watched the show and I'm really, really angry." And, you know, of course, for me, I was like, "Oh no, we totally blew this." And he said, "You know, I'm angry because we don't talk about these things enough." It was a very moving moment because I felt like the community members who had participated in all the story circles, and many of whom were also in the cast, some who hadn't participated in stories in the cast, all these people wanted us to have these topics in the play and grappled with, it really made an impact. That was really the whole point of grappling with those things. Like, Larissa and I are not looking, well, let's find the issues that are going to rile people and upset people. We're asking people, what should be in the play? What should the play talk about? And people could say, we just want a really simple love story and for it to be really sweet. And we would do that. Like, you know what I mean? That would be completely fine. But, you know, it's the themes that sort of rise up that people are consistently saying they want to be in the play that wind up in the play.
Well, the plays we've been discussing are collected in the new book, Native Nation Project, which came out of the collaboration between my guests, Larissa Fasthorse and Michael John Garces. Thank you both so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Yeah, we always love talking with you, Sam. Thank you.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the show. Be sure to join us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show, and we will be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.